and Toby.
Hey, Will. Hey.
Hello. Oh, I'm finally here. Sorry, guys. I should have been wearing these. I didn't see the Zoom link.
Hey, that's okay. Are those your readers or just normal glasses?
Ah, they're readers.
I just moved to reading glasses, and if I don't have them with me, I can't. Like, if I'm at the store trying to buy something, I need to read the back of it. I can't. I couldn't even the other day. I couldn't tip on the receipt because I couldn't. So I just wrote. I knew how to. I wrote like whatever, $5, $10, whatever it was. And yeah. And I just scribbled the amount of the total amount. I just kind of wrote it down, but I knew I could write five or whatever, you know, on that. But I just can't hardly see either.
That's good enough. Yeah. No, yeah. I'm with you. I struggle without them, and it's terrible. I'm 25, and I'm already doing that whole like, you know, the menus can't get far enough away. My arm's not long enough.
Wow, 25 is early for that. I'm still not there.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. 25 bad eyes and bold. I'm living life too hard. That's the problem.
Yeah.
And you're a new dad, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I am. And my daughter's currently upstairs being wonderful and having a good night. So, you know, touch wood, it all stays like that. But yeah, my partner's is looking after this evening. So
awesome.
Yeah, that's crossed. Great. Will, I got to know what your webcam is. It's so great.
Oh, it's actually a Canon. It's a camera. So it's a 700D. It's just a I think you call them Rebel TIs or something like that in the States.
Yeah.
It's just one of them. It's just the UK version of it.
And how do you get it into webcam?
It's just a USB. They launched a webcam driver in September. Great. And I spent most of lunchtime today like cussing and plugging all in and getting the right cable and getting it to work. And yeah, but yeah, it's so much better than, because the camera I've got on this computer is atrocious. And I thought I can't have that. I've got this lovely background. I need to make sure it's all actually, you know, working.
Your setup looks as good or better than anyone I've encountered. And they've all been getting really good since the pandemic. Everybody's been like up in their game slowly, but yours is seems to be the best one yet, right, Toby?
Yeah,
thank you.
I mean, I think that's what even kind of so Will and your website's We Lock It, Will Lock It, Lockit with two T's .com, and people can find you there. We'll talk more about that in a little while, but I stumbled upon you on Medium and started reading some of your articles. The first one I read was about the fake volcanoes, and then about Elon Musk maybe being king of Mars. And then I went to your website and just saw how good your video looked and how you're a storyteller. You care about gripping storytelling and stuff like that. And that just is right up our alley too. Like, we think storytelling is probably the most important thing. How you tell a story, how you present and receive information is really through storytelling seems like the most powerful to us. So it is.
And I'm forever amazed at how terrible science is at that aspect.
Exactly.
And obviously with the podcast being Bad Christians, for me, it's such a wonderful kind of topic to talk about, because I love science, hate how it does its storytelling. But at the same time, I did grow up in a Christian household. I mean, it was Protestant Church of England. So it's kind of Christian light, but nonetheless, you know, the storytelling and the emotional connection that went on with that was incredible. And then as I started wanting to get more and more involved in science and kind of got past just your basic documentaries, all of that storytelling just fell away. And so that's kind of where all of that started from. But yeah, so well, thank you for reading, Toby.
I think you're right too. Within Christianity, I think that's why Christianity, maybe all religions, have become so prevalent, because they rely on storytelling. I mean, the whole Bible is supposed, stories from different cultures and times and what they were going. And so then it becomes fascinating, and then it becomes part of our culture and our narrative as well. And you're right, like science, all through elementary school and growing up and everything, it was just get this information just so you can get a good grade and move on.
Yeah. Learn the facts, spit the facts out, and you'll be good. Yeah. Which is not what science is. It's ironic. Right. They teach you science by teaching you the opposite of science, because science is all about curiosity and discovering the abject truth and trying to actually test things. Whereas I don't know what it's like in the States, but in the UK, the teaching of that was very, yeah, learn this fact. This is what the world is like. Move on. And that's not right. what it's about, really, which the, I couldn't
the
believe.
The problem with science is that it's if you could zoom out far enough, you can see the evolution of the cosmos or the evolution of a species or whatever it is. You can see it as a narrative. But to be able to gain such that level of appreciation is quite complex, is the problem with it. And so if you can't, like, I've been thinking about evolution since I was very young and very attracted to it and very, very not understanding it. And I think about it all the time now and become more and more enthralled by with what I'm able to understand on the longer time scale. And I think in 40 years, I'm going to really understand it better. So that's a real barrier to start with. Like, what a talent it would take to start telling somebody that's five or whatever. It just doesn't, I mean, there's a way to do it, but that's more of what the Bible and everything does, is it is evolved storytelling fundamentally. Yeah. Like, it's a simple message told a billion times, evolved, distilled. Cain and Abel, it's a short story. It tells everything. I mean, it certainly was told many more times in a longer, worse way previously. Yeah. And this is what we're left with.
The story itself has evolved over time, hasn't it? You know, the versions of it which work have stuck. But this is where, like, are you guys aware of the different, like, if I said, like, reptilian and mammal parts of the brain, I'm going to really annoy some neuroscientists because I'm not biology. But I understand there's these two different bits, and you've got your critical thinking part of your brain and you've got the emotional part of your brain. Mm-hmm. And storytelling is all about emotion. And so, you know, you're talking about Cain and Abel, and just the visceral nature of those sorts of stories really grabs your heartstrings and pulls you into it. Mm-hmm. Whereas the critical thinking of evolution, logically that makes sense, but it's a much later evolved part of your brain, because emotions are like the code of basic brains. You know, like, I'm hungry, I must go and eat, I'm scared, I need to run away. Mm-hmm. But critical thinking and problem solving is really difficult, and so the more basic part of your brain always wins over. So that's when you come across, you know, because I've had conversations with people who just who just don't believe in evolution at all, and they categorically deny it, and it's because they are so emotionally connected to these stories, and they don't want these stories to be false, and it's because of these two different brains, two parts of your brain just colliding and not being able to agree with each other.
Right. I think, too, it's that the storytelling has been pretty bad about that, because, like, when I first started hearing about evolution, I just thought, well, that's the silliest thing ever, because, you know, I grew up in South Carolina, very Southern, very fundamentalist Christian. And I was like, well, that's just terrible, because I didn't come from an animal. You know what I mean? So the story was, you're just some animal. So, you know, but I think of myself as a human, and I have my brain, and I can think, you know, in ways that an animal never could. As opposed to, what if the story would have been told to me, look at this amazing lifespan and how things happened, and look what changed, and this had to happen so this could, like, I could have been told a story where it's the most magnificent story ever, that we came from an amoeba or something like that. Could have been a magnificent story. Instead, the story that prevailed in my life was, you're just some animal, get out of here, I ain't believing that, you know?
Yeah. And I think part of that also is you're dealing in such huge quantities of time when it comes to evolution. Right. You know, like, life possibly started 4 billion years ago, and we just can't get our heads around a billion years. And I think the other thing with evolution is the fact that it does imply that life started on its own, you know, and that life is an extension of geology and chemistry. And that, you go, yeah, logically it doesn't make sense, and emotionally it doesn't make sense, but when you go back through it, it's brilliant. But I found an amazing story for evolution. You guys may have read, it's in one of Carl Sagan's books, Cosmos. He talks about in Japan there are these crabs, and they have the perfect face of a samurai on their back, and the local fishermen don't hunt them. And for ages, evolutionary scientists were like, you know, like, how come this is? It's like a picture perfect version of a samurai on their back. And evolution scientists were really confused as to what happened, but they found out that locally there's this tale of this samurai warship that didn't back down and were defeated, and they were sunk. And then the local lore was that the crabs were the samurai, and so the local fishermen stopped catching the ones which had something on the back which looked like a samurai. Wow. And then over generations and generations and generations, the ones which were caught less and returned had more kids. And so this picture on the back of them got more and more and more and more like a samurai. Wow. And that happened within the space of 50 years, 100 years. And it's stories like that when you get like a macro evolution. And then you go, if that can happen over 50 years, 4 billion years, you can do quite a lot.
Yeah, and that's like a moth changing after the Industrial Revolution from white to gray in one generation or something.
Yeah, well, and that actually happened where I grew up.
Oh, really?
So I grew up in the Midlands in England. So yeah, so all of those stories. That's yeah, and they're starting to turn back to white now. Those moths actually.
Oh wow!
Which is really cool when you think about it. It shows a progress that you know modern technology and pollution have you know, started to combat. Brilliant. I absolutely love that sort of stuff.
Well, one of your articles that was that really just stood out to me, okay, because we're Elon Musk fans, and you were writing, I think I have it here, you wrote a couple of articles about it, but...
I find him so intriguing. I can't decide whether I love him or fear him.
Yeah, right. I don't know if fan is a great word.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I don't know if I would say fan for myself. I don't know if I'd identify as a fan.
Really. The thing is, I'll keep on writing those articles going like, oh, he might be like ruler of the world in a few years. I need to make sure I word these correctly.
Yeah,
I agree.
It's something to, he's a fascinating figure of interest and well-deserved curiosity aimed his way, skepticism and optimism. I mean, I'm in the camp of that, like pay attention here and try to, I utilize him as a figure of, what is he doing on the meta level? And I'm trying to reverse engineer his thinking because it's fascinating and useful.
Very subversive with a lot of what he does. It's not what it appears on the surface.
Right.
Just need to dig a little deeper. And there's a grand plan. And I think that's what makes him such a mysterious character. And why he's got so many fans.
Yeah, that's what's fun about it. And his style of thinking is incredibly inspiring. You know, just to say, anybody who has aspirations that likes to dream big,
go for it.
Can think, well, what would be the Elon Musk of X? Like that is a great thing to be able to think in. You know, in that paradigm.
And again, it's about length of time as well. Like we're talking about, you know, the length of time of evolution. I'm amazed at how his foresight for what the world is going to be like in 10, 20 years and his ability to position himself in markets which don't yet exist and go ahead. That's basically his whole shtick, isn't it? You know, it's like, internet payments don't exist yet. PayPal. Commercializations of space, SpaceX. You know, it's unbelievable how he positions himself like that.
Do you think that a lot of his stuff is, I mean, it's hard to, like, some people think that a lot that he does is a gimmicky or show or misdirection from another thing or a show-offy thing, but it's for some other purpose. You can see it's not just some silly game. But nonetheless, do you find that... it's hard to deny the progress he's able to make. Once he has a colony on Mars, people say he's just doing that for the publicity. But you'll be on. It's like he did that for cynical reasons. Well, it still did it though as a byproduct. So, is there a negative externality somewhere else to be worried about?
Yeah, I think there is always a game plan with him. Where whatever it is, even if it might appear like a gimmick, like the Cybertruck window smashing. I mean, come on. That was going to get news. And the fact that when you realize that Tesla spends $0 on marketing and you realize that all of its stuff is just buzz from this one man, he has to do that. It's just like, it's like guerrilla warfare in business, right? But
you're saying the thing breaking was itself intentional to create drama.
I'd never say that. I don't want to be libelous for anything. But, you know, I'm just saying that there's been a lot that's happened that's been very useful to him and stuff like that. And the one
there's
that
no such thing as bad publicity.
Exactly. The one that highlights for me massively is Starlink. This might actually be one of the articles you read, Toby. There's a terms of service in the beta Starlink thing, which basically says that you're agreeing to... Mars being autonomous. So currently Mars is owned under international law. It's like the Antarctic and the Arctic. No one can go there, stick a flag in here and go, it's ours. But he's put in this terms of service buried deep underneath there that Mars can be fully autonomous and he can set up a completely Mars base that we can, which just has no connection to Earth. And people have started realizing, going, oh, you can't quite do this. But the trouble is that if governments like the UN and groups like that start using Starlink, they're setting a precedent. And so they might actually be giving Mars to Elon Musk by using Starlink. Wow.
So there's a deep strategy in that, because there'll be some reference in a court battle where...
Yeah, you know, they go, well, you guys used it, and it said that you were going to give Mars away. So what can you do? And I'd be amazed to find a lawyer who could fight that. I mean, you Americans just have a completely different system to us, and you have lawyers which are far more on it. But I'd be amazed if someone could get out of that. but that's what I mean. There's always a game plan somewhere, hidden somewhere in what he does. And his thinking is like a puzzle. You've got to unpick it piece by piece by piece. And sometimes it leads to something amazing and wonderful and good. Other times it's a really big power move like that one. And you kind of go, oh, yeah, is he a Bond villain?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I had never even thought about that until I read your article. Elon Musk, self-crowned ruler of Mars. I was like, I didn't even think about that in the sense of moving him into explorer and then finding a new land and then planting that flag there. And then if he paid for it and did it all, and it, I mean, he does have some say, I mean, and I'm sure he's, like you said, he's backing up maybe even legally with, you know, whatever contracts and stuff he's pulling off, that he would be the person that is there and building it and owning it maybe. I mean, I mean, you can talk a little bit about your article, you know, just for the folks, but yeah, I mean, I thought that was fascinating.
It's absolutely incredible. And the thing that I haven't quite figured out yet is why he is so interested in going to Mars. I mean, he has this whole thing about being an interplanetary species and having a second place for humanity to exist, but
you don't buy
actually
it.
Get down. Pardon?
You don't buy it based on just on the surface there.
Mars is such an inhospitable world. It's so, well, we think of it as our sister planet, but Venus is actually far closer to Earth. I mean, it's been ruined by insane global warming, basically. But Mars, it's too small. The atmosphere is too thin. There's not very many what we would consider nutrients, or there's a lack of substance we need to live there. It'll be difficult to grow food there. Even if you manage to get the atmosphere to be thick, the atmosphere will be depleted within a few hundred years by solar winds, because there's no magnetic field. And when you start going through all the different problems on Mars, you just go like, oh my God, like one of my articles coming up is all about how energy deficient Mars is, because it gets only 60% the amount of light. There's no usable uranium on the planet. The atmosphere is so thin that wind turbines can't work. And so the question for me with Musk is, why is he trying to get onto Mars? Is he just trying, is that his legacy, or is there something else? Is there something that he's seen that I've overlooked or other people have overlooked, which is with that man is possible? So I'm sure he has a reason other than just he wants to be this explorer and be the first on there, but I haven't quite figured it out yet.
So
I don't think people will.
If a super smart or powerful entity, in this case, maybe a person or company or set of advisors or whatever motivates him, if they wanted to do something very, you know, aggressive or grandiose in any way, they obviously would know that they need a myth or a narrative or a story to attach it to, because the story lodges in people's brains, of course. Yeah. And the one of going to Mars is just, oh, yeah, I can. Yeah. It's right there. Like, we all have it. Like, you can think about what you would do on Mars, and Toby can think about what he'd do on Mars, and you could spend 5 hours by yourself thinking about what that might could mean. And so it's just such an addictive.
It's just such an addictive
right.
It's
story.
The emotional attachment, isn't it?
Yeah.
That because space travel, you know, since the Apollo missions ended, the idea of space exploration has not really grabbed everybody. I mean, the ISS is incredible, but it didn't quite have the same sort of, you know, like man on the moon like energy to it. And he's recaptured that spirit, and it is a way of potentially being a you know, I mean, like, NASA's already agreed a contract with them. They're going to build a moon base. So it's obviously working in the general public and also in business. So you are right. It could just be a mythos and an emotional attachment for their marketing.
Yeah.
Which, if that's the case, wow, that's an expensive marketing.
But it's better than that, in my view, because it's not like you say how he doesn't spend money on PR. So that's quite interesting, because that means it's like he's figured out something in that it's both motivating to the press. It makes him look good. And I guarantee you the genuine belief of those of the people he attracts as talent, that in itself might be the paramount reason for the narrative to be. It's attractive to people like me. I want to sign up for the religion. I want to do it. I'm in. And it's almost
cult-like, isn't it? His followers. I'm a cult inner circle person.
Yeah. I'm a believer. I mean, I want to give myself to cults. That is my tendency. I've done it before. I'll probably do it again. I just try to understand, and I spend a lot of time trying to analyze everything I do in a cult-like thing. America, I think, is obviously a cult that I participate in to some degree. It has a myth. I mean, I think even a human system is like your own self is basically a.
It is.
You know, your family system.
I have to say, as a British man looking at America, because obviously our national identity, ever since the empire decided it wasn't going to be a thing anymore, has been we're not patriotic, no, straight up a lip, we're not proud of ourselves, and part for the football hooligans. And then American patriotism, because I've only met a handful of Americans face to face and been around them, but they were sailors. I used to sail for Team GB, and they were the American sailing team. Wow.
They believe, don't they? They just believe. It's like this.
It is.
Ultra belief, and you can have it, and it. But the thing is, it does work. If you can give all of the people and all of your employees and all your senior level management a very clear vision far off in the future, they will solve all the problems if they can believe enough.
Exactly, and that's the right word as well. Vision. It is a vision. It's a clear vision. It's a clear narrative of this is where we're going. Yeah. And you just look at some of the people who work for SpaceX and some of the things they've been able to pull off. I'd be surprised how much of an engineering hand Musk had. I mean, I know that he does have a level of some of the bigger decisions, but when you actually go through the minutiae of how Teslas are put together or how the rockets actually work, and you realize just how far ahead they are of anything else, that's hundreds of people's life work has been done in the past decade.
Yes.
Just on these one models, on this one rocket, and it's all because of that vision, and they've all been able to work together because of this emotional attachment, and it's beautiful. It shows what we can do, and we need leaders like Musk, and that's why I kind of love him and fear him. And I had the same feeling about Trump, because it's like he can emotionally attach people in, he can get them involved in the vision, and then he is in control.
And they can do the work themselves without a bunch of training. Like, what? It's not like he has to go around and tell everybody what. Like, everybody already inherently already probably had the goal before they heard of him. And so there's something, I guess my main theory this way, I just don't know if it's way out there or not, but to me, well, I watched the Neuralink demo with all the employees, he let the employees all talk, and like they're not coached up, they're not trained. I mean, they're all in, and they know what they want to do, and it happens to be what he allows them to do, and he doesn't overly guide or guard that. But to me, I think he has probably been one of the first people to truly harness and architect the way to really utilize the neurodiverse population. I think he is intentionally looking for alternately wired people. Like, he's seen the system of America that just makes workers and factory workers and neurotypical stuff. And he's taking all these weird people and the tech people and the autistic people and every type of different brain wiring and figured out a way. Those people, nerds, I mean, and just let them work on their own project, and they will do it and give them freedom. Yeah, and so that's scary to some people, but it's also beautiful in another way. I don't know if that's his goal or not, but it seems like the way he's utilizing talent, it eliminates all the bureaucracy, the all those things, but it's a new system of motivating people he's attracting a certain type of people, and that seems to be the type of person, and those people are incredibly self-motivated. So,
yeah, they are.
That's a very efficient way to go. And then you're going to go build some. I mean, it just appeals so deeply to those people that feel outsider or different, but they're very smart. They're very creative. They're very restrained by the workplace and every school system, and they just want to help. So it's almost if you could just figure out how to harness them, has to be the narrative. That's what unites them. I don't know.
But I think you're onto really good things there with the whole, like, you know, the employees have freedom to create. And I think that's the thing. You don't have advancements without creativity and without thinking outside the box. And a lot of corporations really struggle with that because they want, you know, they want the man in the box. They want the thing to just to work, copy paste, and that doesn't work. And then when these big corporations experiment and they try and do these creative projects, because there isn't that collective vision, they end up being, you know, it's like the old saying, you know, the camel is the horse designed by committee. You get those kind of bureaucratic, terrible decision makings. You need that vision. And I can't think of any examples that come from our side of the pond, but from your side of the pond, early Dodge factories, the car manufacturer, they had a special workshop set up for employees to go and just be creative and think outside the box. And that's why their earlier cars started really trouncing some of the Ford cars. You know, obviously we don't have Dodges over here, but when I was finding out about the fact that these ways of encouraging your workforce and the people underneath you existed, you know, 80, 90 years ago, and we're only just starting to really understand how to utilize them. And it's brilliant. I mean, as I've worked as an engineer in the past, and I sometimes felt like I was the man in the box, copy paste. Mm-hmm. But I was given a few free reign projects to go and try doing this, that, and the other. And it was wonderful. I think it was one of the most fun I ever had as an employee.
Wow.
Yeah.
One of the other data points on that is you know, vehicles are, there's something very, very deep about humans' love for vehicles. Like the 1-year-olds, 2-year-olds, the car, truck. My son's obsessed with trucks and mechanically. So,
that's a beautiful fascination. That curiosity that goes along with mechanical engineering from a young age is fantastic.
And then it mixes with power and status in cars and trucks. And I was just looking at this 40s truck in my neighborhood. It's this 40s Ford pickup. And it is just, I can't get over how much I like. I go look at it almost all the time when I'm walking in my neighborhood because I know where it's parked. And it's just the lines on it. And it's and you can tell it's a Ford. And then it was, you can see how it went through the 60s and 70s. And then you can trace the line of it. And you just keep on going with all the people that have always been interested in making those 1 second better. Bit smoother forever, and then extend that into space travel. It's the same. It's like it's just taking that obsession that a child can have, and it's eventually that's rockets, and then it's
just turning up to 11. Yeah, right. I mean, I'm not surprised the next Roadster is going to have rockets in it. That was just a matter of time.
Yeah.
But you are right, and I mean, obviously, we over here we don't have those sorts of old cars. There's only two good old British cars, and that's the E-Type and the Mini.
Yeah, the Mini, and you got some Land Rover stuff that's old. That's cool, right?
Oh yeah, Land Rovers are quite cool when they work. And the thing is, over here, I've heard they cost tons in America, but over here they're not too bad. But I used to live right next to the Morgan factory, and I think you guys do get, you know, the really, like, they build them like they look like they're 50s, but now they're kind of like modern retro, but they've been doing it since they started. And there's something about them, they've retained that mechanical engineering that a lot of modern cars have lost. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of electric vehicles, but I do miss that. It's the mechanical tick, you know, tick tock, that moves. It's the sound, the visceral. Exactly. You are right. There is something so emotional about those machines. And I think electric cars are losing it, but rockets 100% have that just thumping power. I desperately want to go to Florida and watch one of these rocket launch and feel it in my chest and experience that raw power, because it's
that's what it's about.
It's primal. And you don't
it's
quite
like
get
better
it
than and it's like it's a tiger and then a truck and then a rocket or something. Like they're amazing. It's just like and some people stay closer to animals or nature, but there's something about, like, if I can go walk on a beautiful hike, I like that. And I can learn a lot by trying to think about the mechanics of nature, but I can learn more faster by analyzing machines.
Yeah.
There's more for me to think about tangibly. Yeah, that's right.
When you can see it all and you can actually touch it all and you can understand it, so many people say that they first fell in love with a car when they got the bonnet open and they repaired something. And there is something about learning with your hands that you just can't get away from. And you are right as well. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. There's no top end. I don't know what's going to be right at the top. I'm speculating that huge speculation. Musk keeps on saying we need to nuke Mars, right? Keeps on saying we need to nuke Mars. The amount of nukes he'll need is something on the order of about 10,000 nukes. That's a lot of uranium. Rather than using that, he could make a nuclear pulse rocket and take us to the next star and then colonize the exoplanet on that star. Yeah. And that
what,
for me
what,
is like,
hold on, you got to slow down for me. What do you mean?
So there's several different versions of this. So one of them is Project Longshot. Another one is Orion. Basically the idea is you take a rocket rather than having, you know, oxygen and methane combining together and making the thrust. You instead basically have a series of atomic bombs behind the rocket and you just explode them in pulses. And because the energy density is so strong and because the thrust is so high, you can get up to sensible percentages of the speed of light. And actually start to think
sub
about
50% percentages
we're not talking like 80-90, right. We're talking sort of on the order of 5, 20, 30.
Still, that's unbelievably fast.
Yeah.
It's still unbelievable. The only issue with these things is then how do you stop at the other star? Because you need to carry enough bombs to stop yourself. Otherwise, it's just, you know, Proxima Centauri just whiz you by.
So the only way you could stop yourself is a bomb as well.
Yeah. So you need two rockets. You need one on the back, one on the front. And I have done the math for this. It's in one of my articles. But yeah, just the amount that you need and the size of this rocket is kind of similar to the order that you would need to terraform Mars. If you manage to get that amount of uranium together and you manage to get past all this, the current laws about atomic bombs in and above the atmosphere, you could think about going to Proxima or what's the other one? Tau Ceti, I think, is the other one.
But that's still how long of a trip if you did that math? Even at...
If you could travel
10%.
Speed of light, it'll be 5 years.
But with
the current sort of technology, I'm having to remember this off the top of my head because this article is a few months ago, but it's something on the order of about 100 years to get there. And that's to speed up, slow down, and then land on the planet. Might be a little bit longer. But that is still just about doable. We need to sort out some hibernation issues. We need to do there's a lot more than just strap a load of nuclear bombs and just woohoo, off you go. But for me, you know, we're talking about just like scaling up and scaling up and scaling up. Like those sorts of rockets are possible, and if we can get around some of the issues with them, that is the next big level. And I'm convinced at some point we'll see that.
But that technology could terraform Mars.
Musk keeps on saying, let's drop all these nuclear bombs on Mars. You need to do so much more to Mars. So,
if you drop a nuclear bomb, all those nuclear bombs on Mars, that creates atmosphere or something. What is that? What happens?
So basically, Mars has an ice cap. So it's got loads of frozen water, but there's also frozen CO2 in there. If you drop all of those bombs on there, the idea is you vaporize all of that stuff and you end up getting a load more CO2 in the atmosphere. Load more liquid water, and you end up causing kind of the equivalent of a nuclear winter, but in the other direction, just because of how Mars all works, it would actually start warming up.
So it's like a insulation layer, basically. Like the nuclear winter would give you a atmosphere that then solar energy could heat and retain.
Yeah, because at the minute, the Martian atmosphere is only about 10% the pressure of Earth, so it's very, very thin, and by putting all of the heat from these nuclear bombs in, you will, you know, basically take more out of these ice caps. And then the theory is there will be some sort of like a cascade where it will start getting warmer and warmer, and the atmosphere will start getting thicker and thicker, and it will start just keep on going. But that doesn't quite work. You need a lot more CO2. You also need like ammonia, CFCs in theory to be able to work that. Because Mars, it needs so much more greenhouse gases than we do here on Earth. You know, it gets 60% the light that we do, so it needs a really good insulation layer. And then there's water. We need a load of water there because there's none left. It's all boiled away and gone, so you need to crash tons of comets into it, and then they'll also bring their own greenhouse gases. And
big project.
Big project. But I mean, the other thing is, if you're going to live somewhere, don't send 10,000 nuclear bombs to it.
Well, no, the time scale of any of that, there's so much more innovation that could happen from printing, rearranging atoms. I mean, in 1,000 years from now, will we be able to just rearrange atoms and make, you know, ammonia and methane from
nanobots and stuff like that is quite incredible. I mean, the other thing as well is we are starting to understand different biology that can actually survive in Martian conditions. So again, I've got an article which I've literally just sent off to the publication on Medium. It's all about how cyanobacteria can survive on Mars. They need pressurizing, heating, and lighting, but they can survive within the atmosphere at a severely lower pressure than here on Earth. And it's the first organism that kind of can survive in a very kind of basic bioreactor on the surface of Mars without any major systems and all this kind of stuff. And as we start to understand these sorts of creatures, we can start engineering them so they can survive on Mars. And then that's when you start looking at, if you want to have like radiation recovery, certain types of fungi are amazing at that. And so we might just start spreading all of that across the planet. And yeah, you are right. There are so many innovations that could come along.
Like we can modify ourselves, though, with, you know, we'll just genetically modify ourselves to be non-human. We can build ourselves into Martians that require a different type of atmosphere. I mean, you'll still need something, we can be different when we go, can't we?
Yeah, we could be.
Can't
I think
we
the other thing we have to remember is
that are suited for Mars, not literally exactly in one step, but we can, we could genetically modify people for it, they to be able to inhabit those.
That's
different
100%
conditions that we can.
Yeah, I mean, you look at things like CRISPR and how that is advancing genetic modification and making it quicker and cheaper and easier and things like that can happen. The other thing to remember is we will evolve once we're on Mars. You know, it's one heck of a journey there and it's one heck of a journey back. And if we're going to have a colony there, they are going to have to reproduce and live and grow on Mars. And it won't take many generations for those who are better suited to the lower gravity and the higher radiation and stuff like that to work. I mean, I would not survive long on Mars at all. I'm naturally a ginger, pale skin, I get burnt in moonlight, I would get skin cancer within days on Mars. But that's the thing, yeah, we will evolve once we get there and we will adapt to that. It's because it's so different. And we forget that we have evolved for such a specifically weird little planet that everywhere else is so inhospitable to us that we do have to change dramatically to survive on these places.
Right.
And whether that is engineering prior or just coping once we get there and just letting the awesomeness of evolution whittle us down, but we will just have to be prepared to lose a lot of people if we're going to choose that one.
Yeah, well, it'll be something we do in tandem with nature to speed up the process of evolution. I mean, we're clearly suited for this environment for a very specific reason that we are. It's not that we need to find exactly an Earth, but
no.
You know, and then in the longer remote time, we might be sending ourselves in some other form, this non-physical or something. I mean, anything's really possible, but that really puts us in you could really see technology being so different that you couldn't recognize it, and many things are possible that we won't even understand how it works when it's time for that. You know, once we've done all that stuff, us now probably will not even be able to understand what they mean when they talk about where they go and what it looks like. But getting there, it seems like it could be actually a real issue. Like does it feel to you that whether or not we escape the planet is very up for grabs when you talk about Drake equation, Fermi paradox, stuff like that? Do you think what's your take on where we are in the great filter?
Oh, we're going for existential crisis, are we?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Like, because clearly you could think.
That's my jam. We're all good. I'm in my element here.
Good. But I think you have to, because if you just zoom farther ahead and you don't pre-qualify what human life is and what transhuman life is, you could just assume things could be for sure worked out in a million years from now. I mean, it's not even worth talking about.
Like.
But it's just, can we survive another 100 years? Can we survive another 500 years?
I'm optimistic. Personally, I'm very optimistic. I think in the near future, and when I say near future, I'm talking the next handful of generations, you know, 200, 300, 400, 500 years going into the future. I think we possibly won't be leaving the solar system. I think we'll be staying here. And that is when the great filter could start coming in. I think, I don't know about how you guys feel, but I do feel like lots of different international communities are now working together a lot more. They understand that nuclear war is not a very good idea. Yeah. And at the minute, we're proving that humanity is capable of dealing with incredibly deadly pandemics and coping with some extraordinary things. I think climate change could still finish us off. There is some scary stuff coming along with that. I did an article called There's a Monster Under the Arctic. When you start realizing there's enough methane trapped underneath the Arctic to basically cause one of the biggest mass extinctions ever, and it only takes 1.5 degrees of warming to release it, that is terrifying. Yeah. But that will happen in the next few hundred years, and those are the big challenges. Once we get past there, we definitely can get to the nearest stars. As I said, we have concept rockets right now that we can build with technology right now. It will be a monumental effort, but we could get to the nearest stars. And we already know there is a handful of nearby planets which are potentially in the habitable zone. You know, we're talking 5, 10, 15 light years away. These are potentially reachable. I think getting to them and having actual flesh and blood humans landing on these things is 100% capable. Whether we can then go into this transhuman era of where, like, we replicate ourselves in AI and we can start living millennia rather than just the, you know, the handful of years we're given, or the computers to do those sorts of modeling are quite astonishing. And evolution kind of shows that this is possibly the best way of getting a human to exist. Yeah. Evolution very rarely gets tripped up in like a dead end and doesn't find a way around. So if we can search the stars as replicated AIs and live for thousands and thousands and thousands or millions of years, I'm not so sure. But the one thing that I'm sure of is the universe is far bigger than any of us ever realize. There's an amazing paper that recently came out that suggested that there's 36 other advanced alien civilizations in the Milky Way, which is brilliant. But the distances between us are so huge that we will never hear a reply from a message. It's just too far away. We probably will never be able to reach these people. And by the time we get there, they will have died and been long gone. The distances within a single galaxy are mind-blowing, like hundreds of thousands of light years across
just in our galaxy.
So, you know, there's this really famous comic strip that's going around online, and there's this little kid, I think he's asking Death, and he's got like this starry night sky, and he says, "Are we alone?" And he says, you know, "Oh yeah, there's loads of them out there, but they're all alone too. You know, we are on a desert island in the biggest ocean you can ever possibly think of." And that's really cool. It means there's a huge amount to explore. But even if the chances of life are really good, we probably will never meet aliens. We probably will never be able to meet an equal like that.
Are the chances really good? I mean, like you seem to be a believer then that definitely there are aliens.
Oh, yeah, there are definitely aliens. I mean, we have such a small understanding of the universe, and we have explored so little of it. You know, the stars you can see in the night sky are the tiniest percentage of the ones that exist in just our own Milky Way. And then there are as many galaxies, if not, I think there's more galaxies than there are stars in our Milky Way. And when you actually start realizing the scales, it's like, we've experienced such a tiny slice. It's like looking at your cup of coffee and going, there's no such thing as sharks. It doesn't exist in this.
Right.
Yeah, there's so much more than we can think of. They definitely exist. And the more we understand about how life starts, and the more we understand, you know, exoplanets and even some moons like Enceladus with its hydrothermal vents, it's got the perfect conditions for life on a moon around Saturn. That's incredible. I mean, it might not have been around for long enough for life to have started, but the fact that those conditions exist there and they are almost exactly what we think started life off on Earth, and it's in our own solar system.
And that's only our type of life. I mean,
yeah. You don't know what other systems might be out there.
Yeah. I mean, there's a Star Trek that where they just go to a place and there's like something that looks like barely something, but it's a sentient life. It just is arranged in such a different way that you couldn't recognize it or interface with it. Even if you found it, you might not even know what it was. So, like, it's not arranged the way we are, but it could I mean, there's a possibility that there could be some other type of consciousness on some other scale or time scale that we can't, you know. If you take the dimensionality and the distance and everything else, it's really wild. You could probably use the analogy with those 36. I guess that's just a statistical model that say there would be 36.
Yeah, it looked at the age of stars. So our star is 5 billion years old, and that's how long it's taken for advanced, you know, aliens or us to come about. And, you know, what they then did is go, how many of these are in the Milky Way? How many of them have got a planet which could have evolved life? And it was all, statistical analysis. They took, like, upper and lower limits, and it kind of went from, I think the lower limit, I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but the lower was like 5. Upper limit was like 19,000, but they ran all of these different variables, and like the sweet spot where the most ones came out was 36.
So that'd be like if we were living in Montana and you found out that somebody told you, and there's no technology, you're just a foraging family of 25 people living in Montana, and you find out there's nobody else in North America, but there's maybe 36 other families spread across some Pacific islands, but their boats don't exist yet.
Yeah. Right.
That's like, it's just...
No, it's like good. You can swim, and they're sharks, and you will die, but they do live over there, and if you want to try going there, feel free.
Right, but just, it's not...
And those people might be more advanced than you and dominate you, possibly, too, right?
That's when when things start getting really scary, and when you start looking at type kind of like one civilizations and like really advanced aliens that possibly out there, and some of the theories as to why we haven't seen any of them yet. It's a tunnel that it's like a rabbit hole. Once you get into that, you go, oh my God, this is terrifying. Right.
What are some of those terrors though? Cause I like that too, but is it like, you know, if any species could become extraplanetary like that, what would ever stop them? Basically, like if you could send a probe that was just information that when it landed somewhere else, it replicated itself technologically and just took over, you could make technologies that wouldn't require, colonizing. You could literally,
you're
could
talking
send
about
technologies.
Kind of like self-replicating. Yeah.
Yes. And that would just sweep the whole cosmos and exponentially.
I think no alien would touch that technology because of the gray goo hypothesis. Which was brilliantly covered in Futurama, as all amazing theories are. The idea is that, you know, you get these machines can like self-replicate and they can evolve slightly, but that means that eventually just they'll try and turn everything into them. And so you'll end up with just gray goo of nanobots as they just kind of like spread like a virus.
But
so I think it's such a dangerous technology, and it would need a lot of checks to work. But the one that scares me is this idea that aliens are silent because we're the only ones dumb enough to send out a handshake. which would suit humanity down to a T. That's
right. Maybe there's a super smart out there that once we make a big enough signal, they'll just come take care of us, and then it goes back to silent the way they like it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
as soon as we get loud enough where they, oh, there they are. Okay. And then they'll put us down or in our place or whatever, and they'll continue the quiet universe. But in the other one, you don't think that machines might have more interest in what to do with the cosmos than biological life and turn it all into computronium?
I think when I like that word, computronium. You should definitely trademark that.
Oh no, I didn't make it up. It's the idea would be that the most valuable thing you could turn any matter into would be something that can do computing to get more computing power. And so you can turn hydrogen, carbon, an ocean on another planet, a star into computer.
Yeah. The world of like powerful. Jupiter brains and things like that when you come into this. And then you end up with simulation theory and it just gets terrifying. But I do think that the distant future of mankind and of space exploration and all of this has to be machines. These bodies we are stuck in are useless, and they're not evolved for these sort of time scales and these distances or even these different environments. And you know, you do have to start looking at the different methods of getting around. But then also there is this whole idea of, you know, if you could simulate a world in which the speed of light was just non-existent, you could travel as fast as you wanted to, and it was as big as this universe, you would go and live in that, wouldn't you? It's so much cooler, and you could visit so many more places, and all this like interplanetary stuff is great. So build a Jupiter brain is a computer which is the size of Jupiter. And if you kind of like scale up your laptop to that sort of size, it can do an insane number of calculations per second, kind of on the orders of which just don't make sense. But it means that it could simulate an entire universe like that. And you can just plug yourself into it and off you go. And I think that's a really good argument against simulation theory. The fact that we're living in a simulation is that the laws of physics and everything, while they are really good, if you could tweak a few, you definitely would. Mm-hmm. Like, right. I definitely would lower the speed of up the speed of light, or do some sort of thing like that, or I would put like patchworks in which would do that without affecting E=mc². And we don't see any of that. You'd make the universe a better place, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, I think that if you could make simulations, that you would make billions of simulations, and this is simply one, and its utility function might be to simulate the past.
Oh,
in which case, it would be just like it is. You know, it wouldn't right. necessarily be for our recreation.
So it's like watching an old Western film
exactly.
or something, right?
Well, there's yeah. something to learn from simulations. Like you run a bunch of...
Right.
Imagine if in 10 years from now, a big scary company was just trying to do big pharma, and they could just run societal level experiments about opioids to find out what's good and bad in a simulation. They would make a billion of those and get the data, and then
it works.
Yeah.
They'll do it. And we're just pawns in one of those.
Yeah, and the chances of that are huge. I'm not sure if I completely agree with Elon Musk about the fact that we're like, yeah, we're definitely in a simulation. The chances are stacked against us. But it's definitely a possibility. Mm-hmm. And I still love the idea that when we finally come up with a theory of everything, just the sky will go black and it'll just say game over.
Yeah. There's something mythological about the simulation hypothesis that I buy into in the same way that I do. Like I said, I'm prone to just, I can get it in my mind and then I can make sense out of it, but I don't have to fully commit. I can just use that paradigm or something that's useful. But the simulation one is attractive to me because it makes sense of the world in some way. It gives a story. So it might just be useful to think that way, and it doesn't matter if it's true, but
it is a really useful framework.
Yeah, it helps us think.
It does, but and the thing is, it's a framework you can grasp. I think this is another big fall down of modern science, is that it's got to the point now where it is so complex. Like, science was getting more and more simple. The equations were getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And then suddenly they started getting a bit weirder, and then they got bigger, and then they got really weird. And now we're in the world of like Wolfram simulations and string theory and all this kind of stuff, and it's a level of complexity which even the people who are doing it don't truly understand it.
Mm-hmm. You're a Wolfram fan?
I think I'm too young to remember the backlash that happened when he first came out with his theory, and I've only just started understanding it, and it holds a lot of merit, and I'm really interested to see where he goes with it. There is this whole argument that is the universe really governed by a single equation, and actually having a set of rules with nodes and all this kind of stuff makes sense. And the recent simulations that he's been doing, which show that things like relativity and I think it's the Higgs boson and all this kind of stuff as well, they all seem to naturally exist within his framework. And that's the thing is that there's this the basis of all of our theories seems to be there. They're not quite right, but with this idea, you could almost imagine like an infinite number of Wolfram universes, just like your billions of simulations, and one of them will have the rules tweaked in such a way that gravity isn't too strong and stars and planets can form, but doesn't quite allow for carbon chemistry because of some weird thing. And then another one which allows for carbon chemistry, but but gravity is too weak and things can't, you can almost imagine an infinite number of universes evolving to the point where there is one which is perfect for life. It makes a lot of sense, but there, I think also the scientists who are working on string theory got a bit cheesed off. They're like, we're doing all this hard work, and then now you've taken the limelight.
Yeah, exactly. They don't like it. The string theory is kind of stuck. Is kind of the narrative on it, or something like that. Like
it is.
How do you see it?
Yeah, and the one thing I will say is that Wolf, from when he first came out, all of the arguments that came against him were true. Was that if Newton was around, he wouldn't have regarded it as a theory because it wasn't testable at the time. Whereas now he's doing these simulations and he's starting to show that there's these particles which might potentially exist, which will prove him correct. Now we're getting to the point where he can actually enter the argument and he can actually say, look, I predict, let's go and test it. And, you know, that's when this starts getting really exciting because string theory is not quite at that level yet where it can make a categorical prediction and we can go and test it either. So it's kind of not really a theory yet either. I mean, there's some different versions and there's lots of arguments within it. So it's going to be incredible to see what happens with that portion of science over the next few years.
It's almost like when you get in the simulations and stuff like this, it turns back around to things start feeling like intelligent design again. It's a weird part.
It does. It does. And I'm a huge believer in the multiverse. I'd like to think I have a really critical brain and that I'm not, like, as you put it, culty. You'll get along with the whole thing. But the more and more you think about how the laws of physics seem perfect, you know, a tiniest tweak and we wouldn't exist. The tiniest tweak and everything we know falls apart. There has to have been some way for this to evolve or some roll of the dice, you know, continually, which means that we are likely to come about because it seems so unlikely. And so I you know, when you look at Max Tegmark's kind of six levels of the multiverse and you start realizing that, and you also look at quantum, the many worlds theory of quantum physics and stuff like that, everything starts kind of making sense. The only thing you guys must know about, many worlds of quantum and Schrodinger's cat.
And what? Well, what's the end of that, you said?
Schrodinger's cat.
Oh, Schrodinger. Yeah, I just misunderstood.
So with Schrodinger's cat, the cat is immortal because from the cat's perspective, it can never experience itself being dead. So from an anthropical point of view, from itself, it will always live. And the same can be applied to us because quantum events can kill us. And so that's the only thing that really screws my head up with that is that we might be immortal and that we might just live forever while we watch all our friends die because it's all from our perspective. That really screws my head up.
Toby, is that one attractive to you?
Yeah, very attractive to me.
Toby's alley. Talk more about that.
So the idea is quantum immortality. And so the idea is you've got infinite identical universes and they branch off at quantum events. So quantum event is like when something radioactively decays. It's something which is like a roll of the dice. We don't know what happens, but everything from how your brain works to just macro sized events around you can be nudged one way or the other by quantum events.
Even so, like choice, like you chose to go to this coffee shop instead of another one or what?
Yeah, I'll go back onto that one because that's that's when this idea gets
messed. Oh, who free will next?
It's brilliant. So the idea is that you, to everyone else, you will die is the idea, but to you, because they're experiencing their infinite universes and the chance of you dying massively outweigh the chance of you not dying. So whether that's a car crash or old age or whatever, you will get into these situations where something comes to take you off. But for you, because you can't experience those probabilities, you always experience a tiny possibility that you always survive. And so you will just live forever until something which isn't linked to quantum events will kill you. And so, you know, and then there's an argument of how long that is. And is that just like die of old age or is that like you will just stay close to death forever? But then brains appear to use quantum mechanics and so do plants and lots of other different things. That quantum mechanics is really key to how biology works. You know, your synapses wouldn't work without it. You know, everything is triggered by this. So there's a potential that your brain evolved to make use of the quantum many worlds. Because if your brain wasn't a quantum computer and didn't make choices based off quantum events and didn't have some root based in that. And then you made a choice to that actually went and killed you. You've just killed yourself off completely in all of the universes. But if it based off quantum, there's always a chance it will live. And so that life form that has this chance of living will have more offspring.
Right.
We'll have more of them which live like it. And so evolution starts playing in. And so actually evolution might have been affected by quantum many worlds.
Oh, man.
So Toby's inclined, his intuition tells him that he is the special one that is the one in the middle
from this theory, that is 100% true. Yeah.
Well, just the idea that what I'm viewing, I cannot, with any kind of data, prove that it's something that's not just me and continuing, and I don't know. I'm not even going to say it.
And this theory does basically put you at the center of your own little universe that's kind of continuing going on, and it is mad. And what I find so bizarre about theories like that is that they sound like someone has just taken an unbelievable amount of drugs and is just rambling in the corner. It sounds like some nutter who doesn't know what they're talking about, but it actually came from really serious physicists who really understand this sort of stuff, and this is a genuine possibility. It's not a theory. We can't test it yet. Yeah. We might be able to with some of this Wolfram stuff and understanding how that might lead us to understand multiverses and things like that. Yeah. But potentially one day we might be able to. But right now it's definitely a hypothesis. It's a nice idea that works within our current frame of thinking.
Well, here's the amazing thing to me is that it almost seems that we are learning that the infinite is here. Like, you know, we always were taught, like, especially in the Christian world or whatever, that you die, you go to heaven, which is infinite, but you are mortal. But now we're talking about not only our universe, how far, you know, how far it is just in our galaxy to travel to another planet or star or something. But we could just hop into another universe that's right beside us, and then another universe beside that, you know. So the infinite is.
Yeah, so which
is
one are you in? Yeah. The one where the cat never dies. It could be the one you're in out of the many. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Will, we got to wrap up here. Man, we'd love to have you back and talk again. I didn't even get to the article. I want to talk about your article about solar panels and the Sahara. There was so much I didn't even get to.
That was a bittersweet article, that one.
I love that. I was dying laughing when you talked about how much money, how many trillions of dollars it would cost. I was like, whoa, that's crazy. But that it's actually plausible. So we'd love to have you back in the future again. And
I've had a hoot, so I'd love to come back on.
This is great. And folks can find you where? Where do you want people to find out?
Yeah, so I'm on several different places. So I've got a Facebook page, which is W E Lockett. The E is my middle name. It's Edwy, which is an old English name. It's mad, but anyway, yeah. So Facebook W E Lockett. I'm also on Twitter W E Lockett. I'm on Medium as W Lockett, and then my webpage is W Lockett as well. So you can find me on in any of those. Yeah. Ask me weird questions about all sorts of different bits and I'll try and do my best.
Yeah. This is a nice fit conversationally. We could spend more time next time and we could just come up with two or three areas and still not get too far if we want to do climate change or consciousness or free will or the other stuff like this. It's all good.
I'm up for all that. That sounds like a good, awesome. That sounds like a good time.
All right. Well, we really do appreciate it. I promise you, your articles are great. The way you tell the story and explain it and make it entertaining and, I mean, it's just wonderful, Will. So we really appreciate your time.
Oh, Brent. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Well, that was it. Will, this will probably come out maybe next week, maybe next Wednesday. But man, we love this. This is great. Seriously, we would love to have you back and talk more. It was just awesome.
Thank you. Well, yeah, as I said, I'd love to. I'll have to try and see if I can fit it in with everything that's going on with me at the minute.
Right. But you're writing a book, right?
Yeah, I've had to put that on pause for a little bit, as you can imagine. But the trouble is, I've got that whole problem of too many ideas, not enough time.
Yeah,
right. And so I've technically got three books that I'm kind of working on at the minute.
What are they?
Articles. One of them is science fiction murder mystery that happens deep in space as we're colonizing Mars. But it's all really, it's like The Expanse. It's all really scientifically accurate and everything's all there. Yeah. One of them. It's one of my favorite ideas. It's a guide to how to conquer the galaxy. So it's everything we're talking about from like the rockets to the AI, exploring other worlds and stuff like that. But it's written as like a guide for like an evil genius.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's awesome.
And the other one is a collection of short stories about time travel. And it kind of explores paradoxes and practical ways time travel can be used and some of the impacts it would have. I'm so proud of the title for that one. It's called Time and Time Again. And I just thought that was just oh, it's one of those ones that starts with a title and then
I love that.
Went back. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's great. Will, I think you're somebody to really watch. You're 25 years old.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
ambitious. I'll be excited to see your next 20 years, what you'll be into, where those ideas will lead you.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you so much. And yeah, look at the time. I do have to get going. I've got bits and bobs. But it was wonderful, and I can't wait to speak to you guys again soon.
Thanks, Will.
Cheers, guys. Bye-bye.
Matt and Toby.